Skyscrapers, as their name suggests, are designed to be tall. But did you know that almost every inch of these structures is built to perform, from express elevators to mechanical floors? Author Kate Asher joins us to talk about her new book on these man-made marvels. Plus, if you're an old movie buff, you know the name, Hedy Lamarr. In her heyday, she was called the most beautiful woman in the world, but the screen siren was more than just a pretty face. She was also a brainy inventor. Coming up, we'll talk with Pulitzer Prize winner Richard Rhodes. His new book looks at Lamarr's life on and off the screen. One of her inventions, called frequency hopping, is still used today. It's really a great story. Stay with us. If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos, too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Say the word skyscraper. What comes to mind? The Empire State Building or the Sears Tower? But did you know that most of the world's tallest buildings are no longer in the U.S.? The world's tallest structure, by the way, is the 160-story Burj Khalifa in Dubai at over 2,600 feet. It's more than 2.5 times the height of our great Chrysler building here in New York. No matter where they're located, skyscrapers, by the nature of their size, they're going to provide architects and engineers with unique challenges to provide their inhabitants with what? You got your electricity, your plumbing, your clean water, your fresh air, and whether it's in Hong Kong or New York, designing these towering structures to include simple amenities can be very complex and difficult. Kate Asher, author of The Heights, Anatomy of a Skyscraper, is here to talk to us about what it takes to turn these tall buildings into offices and homes for thousands. Ms. Asher is also a principal with HAPCO Consulting and professor of urban development at Columbia's Graduate School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation. She's here in our New York studio. And if you want to get a flavor of the book, The Heights, we go to our website at sciencefriday.com. We have a wonderful little slideshow there. It's a gorgeously illustrated book. Welcome to Science Friday. I don't know how you talk the publisher into making such a beautiful book.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here and happy it's done.
Well, what gets you? I'm a geeky person. I love watching skyscrapers, watching them being built. You know, we had a giant skyscraper built here for about 10 years next door to us. As you say, it's probably the greenest building in the world, or at least in America.
Right.
What got you interested in skyscrapers?
I'm a New Yorker, and I see these things going up all around me, and I always want to peek past the walls of the construction site and understand what's going on. And some of it you can understand, and some of it you can't quite understand. So I thought I wanted to devote some time to figuring out the bits I didn't quite know.
They used to call those sidewalk superintendents, remember?
Right.
There's a little hole in the side.
That's exactly right. You can look down into the foundation and see all the trucks going up and down and watch the cranes come up. It's great.
That's the part. Let's start with the cranes, because to me that is what New York is seeing cranes on the skyline. I noticed in the down where Ground Zero is, they're already building the new building that's going up there. And of course, what do you see? Giant cranes on top.
Right. Actually, you don't see as many cranes in New York as you used to at the moment, particularly in Midtown. You see a lot of them downtown because they're really a sign of a robust economy and
right.
a lot of stuff going up. And for a while, we had very few cranes going up. I think we're starting to see more now.
And how do you get a crane to the top of the building like that?
Well, the really big tower cranes that are putting up the biggest skyscrapers actually erect themselves, which is one of my favorite little factoids about constructing skyscrapers, is they put themselves up and they take themselves down. And how they do it is quite complicated, but I've finally had somebody explain to me. Well, they actually lift up piece by piece of their anatomy, if you will, and they've got a little sleeve that moves up and makes a hole, and they stick in the next piece, and then they move up and stick in the next piece. And the goal, of course, is not just to erect themselves, but to actually carry steel beams and things like that once they're tall. But then they have to take themselves apart again once they're finished.
We used to see pictures of people back in the Depression when they were building all these giant skyscrapers. Men would be out on the end of these I-beams.
And guess what? They still are. There is no way to get two of these beams to bolt themselves together except having somebody there who, of course, these days is strapped in, but they're still out there way, way up high, and they're still fixing those bolts that connect the beams.
Are they still riveting buildings together?
They are still bolting them together and welding them together, and a lot of them are the descendants of the same people that we saw pictures of in the 1920s and 1930s.
And who were those people?
A lot of those were from two Indian tribes that are up in the north part of New York State and Canada.
Wow. 1-800-989-8255, talking with Kate Asher, author of The Heights, Anatomy of a Skyscraper. When there's so many things to talk about. We were trying to decide all the things that go on in a skyscraper. You know, let's talk about the most obvious, which if you're in New York, you see water towers on the top of every building. How do you get the water to go up so high in a skyscraper?
Well, basically, you pump it.
But, I mean, you just can't pump it from the ground up, can you?
Well,
one
no,
pump?
There's a whole bunch of very sophisticated pumps, because even the water towers have to be pumped to get to the,
right.
to the top of even smaller buildings. But there tends to be a very sophisticated network of pumps that in many of the skyscrapers don't actually have water towers. They have water tanks that are on a variety of mechanical floors, and they hold the water and make sure that it's distributed at whatever pressure it's supposed to be distributed to the various floors mm-hmm. in the building.
All right. So how does a skyscraper get started? Is it an idea? Is it an architect's idea? Is it a builder's idea?
Well, the first thing is you have to assemble the land to do it.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, actually getting a land with the right footprint for a skyscraper isn't that easy in a city like New York. And of course, you really only build skyscrapers in very dense cities. You wouldn't put them out in a cornfield. It wouldn't make any sense. They'd never pay for themselves. So you've got to assemble the land. And then basically you have a developer who sits down with an architect and comes up with an idea for a building that has the right program or the right amount of square footage for whoever's going to pay for it.
Of course, it has to be zoned correctly.
It has to be zoned. Well, that's how much land you can actually build up is determined by the zoning, at least in this city anyway.
Mm-hmm. How do you design the foundation? That's going to have to hold all the weight, right?
The foundation has to hold it. First of all, you have to do some borings in the ground to figure out what you're boring through. And here in New York City, there's a lot of bedrock. In places like Chicago, it's clay. And depending on how soft or hard the ground is, you need different types of foundations.
Now, you see pile drivers working. They're just banging like with a hammer. These beams, what are they going in? Are they going literally into the bedrock?
In a lot of the places you see, particularly around here in Midtown Manhattan, they are going into bedrock. That's part of the reason that Midtown Manhattan is so tall, is it's got very good bedrock very near to the surface.
Mm-hmm. And they're just pounding it in there.
They're
the old-fashioned way.
They are indeed.
Hey, you know, do you have to have this kind of heavy granite or bedrock to be able to build skyscrapers?
No, not at all. I mean, Chicago,
that's a
which
myth,
is
right?
The other great skyscraper city, doesn't have any of it. It has soft clay, and so it has a whole different series of foundation technologies that are used because obviously in clay mm-hmm. you need something else to hold that building together.
And in Mexico City, which is like built on a
sand,
landfill, you know, lake or something.
You need very different foundations again, so you're not going to see simple piles being driven in Mexico City or in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that the World Trade Center was collapsed and collapsed. Why did it not survive the fire?
Lots of reasons, and there's fire safety engineers that could explain it better than I can. But effectively, the way it was built, its structure relied on a series of perimeter supports. And the minute that the heat basically allowed the steel to go wobbly, to put it in a simple terms, those steel supports around the perimeter really couldn't hold the floors. And as far as I can tell from the engineering reports, those floors basically were set free and began to pancake down on one another.
Mm-hmm. So what is the most modern way of building a skyscraper?
There's a bunch of different ways. It really depends on the height to which you want to build. So if you're going to go very tall, the wind forces are incredible, and you have to come up with a structure that can support those kinds of loads. If you're building a smaller skyscraper, remember, not every skyscraper has to have 160 stories. So if you're building a skyscraper of 50 stories, you'd probably use a different structure than one that's 160.
Here we wouldn't call that a skyscraper.
Yeah.
It's a little cloud screamer.
Right.
1-800-989-8255. The tallest building in the world, the one in Dubai.
Right.
What was the unique challenge of building that? How could you get it that tall? I mean, and is there a limit to how tall you can build a skyscraper?
Well, the real limit upon how tall you can build it is two. One's economic, in terms of how much floor area can you bring elevators to without sucking up all that land into and all that area into elevators. But really, the wind is the biggest challenge for a skyscraper.
Oh,
the taller
right?
you go, the stronger the forces are, and they get very, very strong. So you have to be able to brace that building and support that building so it can withstand those sorts of wind forces anywhere. It doesn't matter whether it's Dubai, New York, Chicago.
My father, who used to work in the World Trade Center many years ago, used to say he could feel he was up on the 80th-something floor, could feel the and hear the building swaying.
I worked there for 7 years, and he's absolutely right. If you went into the core, which is where the bathrooms were, it was always a bit scary because not only were there no windows, but you could hear the creaking of the building, and people used to say, it's supposed to creak, it's a good thing, but it never felt quite right.
1-800-989-8255. Let's take a phone call or two. Let's go to Jenny in Silver Spring. Hi.
Hello there.
Hi there.
I'd like to know, if you're building a skyscraper in an existing city and you're going down really deep, you're going way below the level of the existing water and possibly electrical, but mostly the water connections. So how do you manage to tie in, since you've got to get it both up to the upper floors and down to anything that's lower, and then get it back out on a different level?
Are you talking about the piping that moves through a building? The water piping moves through the building. It comes in pretty much as it would in a house. Mm-hmm. I mean, it may not be all that different if you're tied into a municipal sewage system and there's pipes that come into your house and move out. The concept is basically the same for a tall building.
1-800-989-8255. And how do you think of all these different things when you're building, you know, all the different, the pipes, the whatever? The ventilation system, right?
It's like a city. There's energy that needs to come to it. That's air that has to move in and out. If you just left the same air in a skyscraper for a long time, you would not have any people living in there.
And now there are green buildings that have other things to think. They recirculate some of the water?
They recirculate the gray water, and they try to keep the air at a temperate climate so you're not having to do as much conditioning of the air. Some of them have solar panels. Some of them have wind turbines, if you can believe it, on the outside. They haven't yet figured out how to self-power a building, how to make enough energy to support the energy needs of the thousands of occupants in it, but maybe one day they will.
There's certainly enough glass areas on the building, right, if you could?
Well, there isn't, but the glass in a vertical form isn't too good for solar panels. Somebody once likened it to trying to get a sunburn standing up. So your buildings are challenged in a solar sense.
And then you got all these elevators you have to put in there, right?
Right,
I mean, they have to move pretty fast, some of these elevators.
They have to move very fast, which is why you see these shuttle elevators that whiz you to some midpoint of a floor and then let you get a local after that, because otherwise they would just spend forever traveling some of the distances in these very tall buildings.
I would imagine they could probably make it faster than it's comfortable for you to be in.
They could. In fact, there's one elevator in one of the buildings in Asia where they actually have to pressurize or depressurize the elevator cab as it's coming down, because otherwise people's ears would pop.
No kidding.
Really?
And then if they're going up, they'd be compressed like little ants.
Right.
Slow it down. I know there was once in the World Trade Center, there was a scientist who put a scale in the elevator. So as it went up, you could watch yourself gain weight.
Oh, that's interesting.
Feel like the acceleration, actually, like artificial gravity.
That's really interesting.
There's all great science of the city. There's great opportunities for certainly big buildings to have fun with it. Talking with Kate Asher, author of The Heights, Anatomy of a Skyscraper. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. And also go to our website and join a discussion there. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. Habla Español. Check out our science news in Spanish over at sciencefriday.com/Spanish. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking with Kate Asher, author of The Heights, Anatomy of a Skyscraper, a gorgeous building that if you've ever wanted to know anything about how a skyscraper works, how it's built, the architecture, green skyscrapers, it's a terrific book and got great illustrations in it. And we were talking during the break about the Skyscraper Museum. There's a Skyscraper Museum in New York.
It's a fabulous museum downtown near Battery Park City, which has a terrific exhibit called Super Tall, which actually shows how the tallest buildings in the world stand up, how they were built, and what they look like, which is fascinating.
One of the things, Joe, of course, the first thing you notice when you're looking at a skyscraper is the outside of the building. And we mentioned a little bit about the windows. Are there many different ways you can build the glass or the windows in a skyscraper?
Yeah, and in fact, not all the windows or not all the skin of these skyscrapers is glass. You still sometimes have stone on the outside. And some of the glass comes in kind of pre-ready to be stuck in there, and others is erected on site. And there's all kinds of different glass as well. So there's tempered glass and fritted glass and all kinds of glass. There's double glass and single glass. So there's a whole worldwide business of importing these big sheets of glass that go as facades of these skyscrapers.
Let's go to Elizabeth in Tucson. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much. I was just wondering. I was looking at a National Geographic magazine a few years ago, and in it there was an architectural illustration of the outside of a skyscraper that they were considering erecting in Japan. And something that was unique about this was that the core of the building almost served as an axis around which each floor would rotate and be blown by the wind. Does that sound familiar?
You know, I've heard about one of those in the Middle East that was being designed not that long ago. So it was a fairly recent iteration of the same idea.
The floor would move around like it's being
This one was not by the wind. It was by some kind of, electrical rotation, regular rotation, but same idea.
Wow. And when all those dials stopped spinning, some cash would come out. Sorry, I couldn't help myself.
I was just curious to see if it had been built or is it still in pre-construction, I view?
Well, it hasn't been built, and there are some engineers I know, and again, I'm not an engineer, but I know a lot of them, and they're all fairly dismissive of the idea. The one thing they haven't been able to figure out with that quite yet is the plumbing and how you wire the plumbing to be able to move around in this sort of infinite circular motion without getting very, very confused.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Let's go to Chris in Holland Patton, New York. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi there.
My question is, earlier you mentioned about the sky cranes. I've always been fascinated by them. And you mentioned quickly how they bring the pieces and just stack them up, but I still can't figure out how they get them off the crane and move them around and lift them on top and how high is each section. And then my other part of the question is, what holds the whole thing up when it's going up? You know, it's a spindly thing that lifts up tons of weight.
Yeah, how does it hold all that weight?
Well, it's very hard to describe without a visual picture. But basically, it's a structural frame. The crane is very simple, very simply a kind of truss-like figure that's bringing the weight up. And each segment that they insert is somewhere in the region of 10 to 20 feet. And of additional frame that's simply going on top of the existing frame. And so it continues to move up pretty much in a linear fashion till it gets to whatever height it needs to be to do the work on the construction site.
If you go to our website at sciencefriday.com in the SciArts section, we have some illustrations from the book that show you exactly how that happens. I'm always just amazed at how long these arms of these cranes are, how much material they can pick up.
It's fantastic. Yeah. I also learned I was always interested in what life in a cab in one of those cranes must be like at great heights. And one of the fun facts that I picked up in doing the research was that the actual compensation of the men who are driving the cabs, the men or women who are driving the cabs, is not a function of how high they are, but how long that arm reaches out. Isn't that interesting?
That's the talent, I guess. You're very talented.
Well, you've got
to
balance the weight. It's tricky, right?
And they have all kinds of stuff in there. The amenities of home, like...
They do. As far as I know, they've got heating and all the rest of, common human needs.
It's like I learned this many years ago from being on the radio in the Midwest. You hear about these giant tractors that have the same thing, and they have televisions and things like that.
Right. Yeah, they do.
1-800-998-8255. Let's see if we have a tweet there. Can buildings become wobbly enough that they will collapse if they're not built correctly?
You know, I was asked that question recently at a talk I gave, and I don't actually know of any buildings that collapsed because they were wobbly in terms of skyscrapers. Mm-hmm. You see buildings collapse, from time to time in cities that are old and left to deteriorate. But in terms of skyscrapers, there very rarely is something like that because these buildings are pretty well maintained. Expensive assets.
Was there anything you couldn't learn that you wanted to know about skyscrapers that was a question that still remains unanswered for you?
No, really, there's things I understand maybe not as well as someday I would like to. How the wind works on a building is very complicated. Those vortices that spin off certain types of structures.
Mm-hmm. So the wind goes around the building and on the other
side? The wind goes around the building and it moves it in certain ways. And I think in some senses you need to be around these models for a long time to understand exactly how they work. Also, how you design a foundation that fits the building. There's a lot of different options in terms of what that foundation could be like. But you actually have to have some sense of how much you want the building to sink, how much is permissible to be able to allow the building to sink when you're designing it. So some of this stuff just, I think, comes to you after years of being in the practice.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Gary in Sacramento. Hi, Gary.
Hi, a question. When designing the tallest buildings, is the mindset that they're going to last forever, or is there a strategy and is there a method for taking one down when once becomes unserviceable or obsolete?
You know, necessity is the mother of invention, and eventually I think you figure out how to do anything. But at the time they're being put up, nobody's thinking about how to take them down. I don't know that there's a sense that they are going to last forever, but you're putting so much money into these investments that you assume they're going to last, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 years, and
well,
some of them last longer.
You know, bridges have a structural lifetime to them. Do buildings have a life?
Buildings don't, because buildings are being constantly replaced. I mean, if you look at some of the renovations, even around a place like New York City, if you want to upgrade a building because it's dated or aged, you pull out the elevators, you pull out an awful lot of the structural elements, you reclad it, and it becomes like new because its component parts are like new.
Thanks, Gary. They're doing a makeover of the Empire State Building, right, with windows and stuff like that?
That's right. They're doing a big retrofit of the Empire State Building, also the Willis Tower in Chicago, to make it both more energy efficient and more rentable.
Yeah, and those buildings are, I'm going to say, they're made like iron. I mean, they're just rock solid.
Right. They're not going anywhere. I mean, a building like the Empire State Building, or even the Woolworth Building, which was built in 1913 in Lower Manhattan, and is still going strong. That's coming up for 100 years old.
And that was once the tallest building in the world. There are a whole bunch of buildings down there.
Right.
Or at one point, were the tallest building in the world.
Right. Tallest, most expensive, and most ornate.
Let's go to Justin in Green Grove Springs. Hi, Justin.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for taking my call.
No problem. Go ahead.
Sure. I was wondering, what do you think the most important invention to affect the construction of skyscrapers over the last 140 years has been?
Oh, that's a hard one, because you can't have part without the whole. So in some ways, people talk about the steel frame, the structural steel frame, to take the weight of a building as a, you know, huge step forward from the masonry walls that were supporting buildings. And that's probably, in some senses, the first and most important. But if you didn't have elevators
right.
to go with that, nobody would want to climb up 80 stories. So, you know, and then you talk about water and power. And so in some ways, you really needed probably three or four or five inventions, including electric light, to be able to make these buildings make sense.
Indoor plumbing.
That too.
Thanks.
Definitely a far cry from the wooden cranes of the 1200s. Huh?
Yes, it is indeed.
Thanks for calling. And of course, you do have to think about the waste system in a building of that size, right? Are buildings coming online now, greener buildings that actually clean their own waste inside the building instead of flushing them out into the sewers?
There's sort of black water and gray water. The gray water is the stuff that comes off sinks. And there's a number of buildings, including some in New York City now, that are recycling the gray water that comes off the sinks and are actually using them in toilets and for landscaping and other sorts of things. The use of recycling black water, which is the stuff that basically comes off the toilets and bathrooms, is not really being used in this country, but in some places in India and other places, there are technologies that are allowing that to be somewhat recycled.
Yeah, and they're also putting in the waterless toilets in some places.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And when people build a big skyscraper now, are they planning them more green?
They're planning them much more green, in part because for marketing purposes, people who are building new buildings want tenants who, you know, really care about the environment. They're all looking to have these green labels. So there's a bit of a race afoot to see who has the greenest building.
Mm. So what's your next book? You're going into a still how it works theme?
It is a how it works theme. It's actually, I guess you could, I don't have a name for it yet. You could think about it as sort of planes and trains and automobiles. It's transportation.
Wow.
Which is an area I actually know a little bit more about than I knew about skyscrapers when I started.
Wow. Well, we'll look forward to it. If it's half as good as this book, it'll be terrific.
Oh, thank you.
The book is The Heights, Anatomy of a Skyscraper. Our guest is Kate Asher. It's a wonderful book. If you've got something on your holiday list, this might be one. Thank you, Kate.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you to be with us today. Up next, The Hidden Life of a Hollywood Siren.
Scientist, mathematician, physicist, bacon eater, yes. But not astrologer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Darling, astronomy and astrology may sound alike, but that's all. Astronomy is a science. Astrology, superstition.
But aren't you a little bit intolerant? For thousands of years, astrology has been highly respected.
Astrology, my love, stinks.
That movie clip is from The Heavenly Body, and the woman with that lovely Austrian accent is Hedy Lamarr. Her scientist husband is played by William Powell, and while Hedy is playing the stereotypical Hollywood dumb broad in that scene, in real life, she was anything but that. In her spare time, Hedy, the glamorous movie star, was an insatiable inventor. Her most famous invention, called frequency hopping, is still used today in some wireless technology, including Bluetooth. You can see her patent up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. Joining me now to talk more about Hedy Lamarr, her life and inventions, is Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Richard Rhodes. His new book is called Hedy's Folly, The Life and Breakthrough Inventions of Hedy Lamarr, the Most Beautiful Woman in the World. He joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira.
You know, I'm a huge fan of Hedy Lamarr. And for many, as my listeners know, I've been talking about her and her accomplishments for decades. There are movie scripts, right, waiting to be produced. A play called Frequency Hopping that was produced. We interviewed the writer and director Liz Singer back in 2008. You're a Hedy Lamarr fan too now, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. Although, of course, strictly for her scientific bent. You'll find a photo in the frontispiece of the book that I think really shows how extraordinarily beautiful she was.
And she said that was a curse of hers, didn't she not?
She did. She really felt blinded or blocked from people seeing the real person. She would walk into a room and people would literally stop talking and look at her, but they never got past her face, which is what that little scene you just played indicates too.
And how did she get, was she always interested in inventions from a very young age?
You know, I think I trace it back to the time she spent with her father, who was a tall, athletic bank director in Vienna, where she was born, and she was his only child. He adored her. They would go on long walks together around the city, and he would explain things to her, technologies. This is how that crane works. This is how that bus works. So in her childhood, she obviously associated the warm feelings she had for her father with this business of technology. And I think that's probably the real source of her interest.
Why do you call it Hedy's Folly? What was the folly in her work?
Well, I think folly is a word that has several meanings. One of them, of course, is the one we all think of. And that's ironic because of the way the Navy treated her and George Antheil's invention, which was, of course, to throw it into the round file. But there's another sense of the word folly, which means basically an extravagance. And I think of her inventive side as a kind of rich, extravagant side of a very extravagant woman.
1-800-989-8255 if you'd like to talk about Hedy Lamarr, and we'll get into her inventions and the one that's most famous about having to do with frequency hopping on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Richard Rhodes, author of Hedy's Folly, The Life and Breakthrough Inventions of Hedy Lamarr, the most beautiful woman in the world. And she was christened that by a movie producer, was it?
Yes. Max Reinhardt, the great Austrian producer-director, called her that when she first showed up in one of his movies as almost an extra. And by then, I think she was about 16 at the time. She got more beautiful when she moved to the United States and lost some weight, actually. She was a kind of typical plump Austrian teenager, but she was a knockout by the time she made her first movie here.
Yeah. And the story goes that, as you tell it very well in your book, and you debunk a lot of the mythology about her escape from Austria and her husband. And you basically say that she always wanted to be a movie star, and she made her way to America.
And someone said of her, one of the first actors who played with her in a play, that she thought of the United States as some sort of large country surrounding Hollywood, which I think is a pretty good idea of where she was. She'd always dreamed of being a movie star. And the only place who could really do that was, of course, in Hollywood. But she had a disastrous marriage at the age of 20 with the third richest man in Austria, Fritz Mandl, who was an arms merchant who had factories making bullets and cannon shells and so forth all over Europe. And they lived, of course, a very extravagant life. But she described it as a golden castle, a golden prison. He was a paranoid man who was sure she was cheating on him with everyone who walked through the room, and she simply felt locked up. Plus, he didn't want her to act. she had acted in a movie that had really made her name as a 19-year-old, where she had had a couple of nude scenes. And that was a scandal in Austria and in the United States as well. Famously, Fritz is said to have tried to buy up all the copies of this film, which, of course, the people who owned the negative simply kept making more copies, making a nice living. And so in 1937, she saw her chance and filed for divorce and made her way to London, where she had lots of friends. Found out that mayor of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer was in town, buying up actresses and actors, as it were, on the cheap in the late period of the Depression, and went to see him. He offered her a really bad deal, and she turned him down and walked out, which I think is some indication of her self-confidence. Oh. And then contrived to sail to the United States on the Normandy, the same ship that he was returning to the country in, and got herself a much better contract.
And we'll pick up the story, a very interesting story about Hedy Lamarr, with Richard Rhodes, author of the new book, Hedy's Folly. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. We'll get into her inventiveness right after this break. Stay with us. Got a hankering for a bit more conversation? You didn't like what you heard. You want to hear more of it? Well, you can keep the chat going at Science Friday's Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/scifry. Or you can tweet us all week long at SciFry. That's at SCIFRI. You're listening to Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the life of movie star and inventor Hedy Lamarr with my guest Richard Rhodes. His new book is called Hedy's Folly. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. So let's continue the story. She gets to Hollywood and she becomes a big movie star, but she doesn't go out and partake in all these Hollywood lifestyle parties, does she?
Exactly. She doesn't drink and she doesn't like parties. She's, after all, she's a very bright woman, and she, her idea of a good evening is a quiet dinner party with some intelligent friends. So she has to find some way to occupy her time. And what she does is take up as a hobby inventing. She sets aside one of the rooms in her house and puts up a drawing table and all the tools and the right kind of lights. There's an entire wall of technical reference books on one side of the room. And she sets herself keeping busy in these off hours, trying to come up with new ideas for inventions.
And she goes so she's at a party and she meets the man who's going to make history with her.
She has begun to be very interested in the war, which began, of course, in Europe on the 1st of September 1939. She's been following the story, of course, because her country was occupied by Germany and therefore is part of the Axis Empire at this point. She's particularly interested in the submarine warfare that's going on between the German U-boats and British shipping, because when she went to all these fancy dinner parties with her Austrian husband, he, after all, was talking to German admirals, German officers, German technical specialists about the kind of problems they were having with, for example, torpedoes and submarines. So she knows a lot about this. And it's particularly interesting to her and horrifying to her in the summer of 1940 when the German U-boats begin torpedoing the ocean liners that are carrying English children out of England to safety in Canada to get away from the Blitz, which had begun the bombing of London and the bombing of England. One ship in particular in September of 1940 was torpedoed with the loss of the lives of 99 children. And she's horrified. And she thinks there must be something I, Hedy Lamarr, can do to stop this terrible butchering of children. And then at this dinner party, just a few weeks later, she meets a young avant-garde composer named George Antheil, who happens at the age of 18, this is his technical expertise from her point of view, to have been an inspector in a bullet factory in the United States during the First World War. Well, as he said later, well, that was the only person she could find who had this particular set of skills. So she says, let's get together and talk about this. She's also concerned about making her breasts larger, and he happens to have written a series of articles in Esquire while he's scratching around for a living about how certain hormones can enlarge the breast. Mm. This is kind of the quality of this story. There are all these strange corners to it as we go along.
And it turns out that
they get together.
I'm sorry, you tell it better than I do. Go ahead.
So they get together over a series of evenings, and they start thinking about, how could you build a torpedo that could be made more accurate? And they think, all right, radio guidance. Yeah, but it's easy to jam a radio signal. And this is where Hetty's invention comes in. For reasons that are not quite clear in the record, but I think there are some antecedents to in her own past, she comes up with the idea that if you could make the radio signal jump around from frequency to frequency at a fairly fast rate, at least a few dozen times per second, that someone trying to jam the signal won't be able to find it. And if they broadcast a big, noisy signal that covers the whole range of frequencies, it will just occasionally sound like a little blip on the 1 or 2 or 3 or 10 or 100 frequencies that the signal is bouncing around among. This is her crucial invention. And they do together get a patent on this idea and its manifestation in a torpedo design. And this brings in George Antheil's interest. He's someone who, in the course of his avant-garde composition, was once faced with the problem of how do you coordinate the playing of up to 16 player pianos. He never succeeded really in doing that. But he did learn about the idea of using a scroll of paper or some other kind of tape that's punched with holes to convey the signal to this piano of which key to play. And by adapting that so that the holes signal an electronic signal to be produced, they devise one form of their invention, which is the one they use in their patent, to show that it's a practical idea.
But you couldn't cram all of that into a torpedo.
This turns out to be the disaster from the Navy point of view. The Navy officers who are involved in looking at this invention don't really get the idea that this player piano system is just one idea, that there are many different ways to make this happen. As Antheil wrote later, you could have put it on a piece of wire and run it through a mechanism the size of a wristwatch, which is true. But the Navy didn't see it that way and said, how are you going to put a player piano in a torpedo? And they threw the invention away.
But many years later, it got picked up.
But after the war, and unfortunately after the invention the patent had expired in the 1950s, a curious electrical engineer with a long Hungarian name, which I can't even pronounce, but who was the son of a series of counts and counts going back in history, was handed this expired patent, and the Navy said, can you use this to make a jam-proof signal for a sonobuoy, a buoy that would float on the water, send down sonar signals if it registers that there's a submarine underneath, would then transmit the information to it, plane flying overhead using frequency hopping to make the signal unjammable. He says, sure. And he designed such a system. At that point, the military picks up on this technology because one of the fundamental problems with military communications is you don't want them to be jammed. And so you find ship-to-ship radios that were on ships during the Cuban Missile Crisis, control systems for missiles from the ground to the missile, ultimately, GPS, the signal that comes back to Earth that we use to read the GPS information, is frequency hopping. And then in the 1980s, when this technology was declassified and was no longer secret, it began to be picked up first on car radios and then on cell phones, wireless telephones, Bluetooth. For a different reason. Now the problem is you have a fairly low-powered signal going around from, let's say, my cell phone to the central tower. And the problem is if everything's on one frequency, they're all going to be interfering with each other. But if every phone can hop around from frequency to frequency, then you can have 800, 1,000, 40,000, 100,000 phones all communicating with that one tower, and they won't interfere with each other in any way that's meaningful.
Well, she lived long enough to see her work bear fruit, but was she very disappointed or upset that she didn't profit from any of this?
You know, she didn't want to profit because she gave the patent to the U.S. Navy. It was her contribution to the war effort. But she did want to be recognized, and particularly because she'd always had this feeling that no one in Hollywood ever understood that she was an intelligent human being. She was never given particularly good roles. She wasn't asked to act, and she was well-trained as an actress. So her Hollywood career was a really bitter disappointment to her, even though she made a great deal of money. And then she had to, as actors and actresses do, she had to deal with, what do I do for the rest of my life? Mm-hmm. And she was pretty invisible for the rest of her life. So she wanted recognition. And in an interview for a magazine in 1990, when she was then approaching her 80s, she said, "People seem to just take and take, and they never give back." She really was unhappy about it. Fortunately, some of the early pioneers of wireless computer systems picked up on the fact that this had been Hetty's patent all those years ago and started a quiet movement to get her some kind of recognition. And in 1998, when she was, I think, about 80 years old, she finally was awarded a Communications Pioneer Freedom Foundation Award and was delighted with it. But when they called her up to tell her about the award, Hetty being Hetty, she said, "Well, it's about time."
And she didn't want to be seen in public at that point, right?
She'd had a lot of bad plastic surgery by then and really was not happy with going out at all. So she recorded a thank you, and then her son Anthony carried the recording to the conference, the convention, where the award was presented, and he received the award and played the tape. And I actually have a copy of a copy of a copy of that tape passed down by these various computer pioneers, which has Hetty's voice on it saying, "Thank you very much. I hope it's been of some use."
While she was in Hollywood, she noodled around with lots of little inventions. What name a few of the little inventions that she was?
I think the most interesting, in a way, is one that she worked on with the help of a couple chemists who were loaned to her by Howard Hughes. I mean, she dated around quite a bit, and I'm sure Howard Hughes was one of her boyfriends at some point. So he loaned her a couple chemists. This was a tablet, kind of like an Alka-Seltzer tablet, that if you dropped it into a glass of water, would fizz up and make a Coke. And it never evidently really worked. She laughed about it many years later. But, I mean, it doesn't sound like a bad idea.
But there was something called fizzies when I was a kid. There was something called fizzies that sort of worked.
Yes,
like that.
Right. I don't think that was her invention, but they did come along. She had some ideas at the end of her life to improve the French-British supersonic passenger liner, the Concorde. She came up with an improved stoplight signal. She had an idea for a little box that would attach to a Kleenex box so you could put your waste Kleenex somewhere. She was obviously someone who was just constantly looking at the world and thinking, well, I can make an improvement there. She had a chair that you could wheel in and out of a shower so that people who couldn't stand could take a shower. She was an interesting woman.
She was Hollywood's first star geek. It sounds like.
She was.
Movie star.
And it turns out there were a few others. Harpo Marx evidently was an inventor as well. So there are these people tucked away in the history of Hollywood who were doing other things. It's nice to know.
Yeah. This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Richard Rhodes, author of the new book, Hetty's Folly, the Life and Breakthrough Inventions of Hetty Lamarr, the Most Beautiful Woman in the World. And I'm sitting here mesmerized by Richard telling the story, and he tells it as well in his book. It's a really interesting book, and people are trying to get, now that your book is out, maybe we'll get to see some more productions of the Frequency Hopping, which was a play that was in production years ago, right? There's a movie about her, scripts floating around about her looking to be cast.
There is, and a German actress has recently optioned my book, actually. I think probably because she wants to play Hetty. So let's hope that this motion picture happens. It's a wonderful story.
Yeah. Are there any parts of her story you could not uncover that remain a mystery to you that you would have liked to have?
Well, you know, most of the previous versions of the story, including that script you were talking about, conflate up a love affair between George Antheil, the composer, and Hetty. And I found that questionable. She always dated taller men than she, and she was 5'7", quite tall for her day. George was an interesting little guy who was about 5'3". Time magazine once called him a cello-sized composer, which I thought was a marvelous description. So it seems unlikely to me, but he was someone who had quite a few affairs in the course of his life, and when he died in 1959, left his wife whatever estate he had and a six-month-old illegitimate son.
Now, there's another myth that is well known, and you debunk it sort of, that the young Hetty, to try to escape from her husband, who was meeting with all these munitions people, these Nazi munitions people, that she drugged her husband and dressed up in the maid's outfit to sneak out of the country. And you say that there's no real record of that happening.
Well, even more, it's as if her escape was a secret. But I looked at the newspapers from the day, and there were big headlines both in this country and in Vienna that Hedwig Kiesler, as her name was then, was divorcing Fritz Mandl. So it was the public knowledge that a divorce was underway. The fact that she got out of town is pretty obviously something he was aware of, may even have colluded in. I don't know. You know, this he escaped Nazi Germany just a year later. He was Jewish and took with him all of his money, which was considerable, moved to Argentina and helped build the air force for the notorious dictator of Argentina. So I think they knew that they were both going to get out of Nazi Germany and Nazi Austria as it was then.
You say in the book that you think that story was, it sounds like the concoction of a movie agent or a studio agent making up a fantastic tale like that. So you're very satisfied with how the book came out and the research and the things that you uncovered.
I am. There's always more that you would like to know. You know, exactly what happened within the government in their decision first not to use this patent and then to pick it up and essentially make it one of the fundamental components of our military technology. That's kind of a mystery because it was all secret information. And curiously enough, a lot of the documentation has never been declassified because of some stubborn decision on the part of the agencies involved that there were commercial secrets involved in all of this. So the real inside stuff about that part of the story is waiting to be uncovered.
All right. Well, stuff for another book for you, maybe, Richard.
Another book.
There you go. Well, thank you for writing this one, because as I say, Hedy Lamarr is one of my favorite inventor characters in history, and I'm glad you filled in and debunked a lot of that stuff for us.
It was fun to write.
Richard Rhodes.
I think it's a fun story.
It's a great story. Richard Rhodes' new book, Hedy's Folly, The Life and Breakthrough Inventions of Hedy Lamarr, the Most Beautiful Woman in the World. Our program's senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Taliata and Alessio Bayak. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Our intern is Francie Deep. Neil Rausch is our technical director and at the controls here in New York. I'm Ira Flato. Thanks for listening.